This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
You're listening to the Book Riot Podcast. It is Monday, August 14th. I'm Rebecca Shinsky. Jeff is out this week. I'm here with Book Riot's managing editor, Vanessa Diaz. Vanessa, hello.
Hello.
Thank you for joining me bright and early in your West Coast timeline on this Monday morning.
We have had some technical difficulties.
We have, as happens to us like once a year or so, a monkey threw a wrench into things. Jeff and I recorded a whole episode on Thursday and it had no sound. So we're back. We're taking a mulligan, which I guess is appropriate. Jeff will be in Scotland for part of the week. Yeah. And I'm delighted to have you here. Thanks for pinch hitting with me.
Of course. No, happy to do it. I'm happy that I remembered to drink hot tea before joining you because it is indeed early over here and your girl has mad vocal fry in the mornings and it was not cute about 30 minutes ago, but we are all set to go.
Have you been doing all your vocal warm-ups?
I have.
La 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 la.
In the heat that is Portland because it's the tropics here today, but I digress.
I feel you. Yeah, it's, I mean, we're deeply in truly the dog days of summer here in the South. It feels like the dog days of publishing, too. Not a lot of big news, but a lot of like news that feels like the equivalent of standing outside on a humid day.
Yeah, that's what we're going to go with.
Yeah, that's how I'm feeling about what's going on in publishing lately. Just for folks listening, Kelly Jensen, one of our editors, will be here with me for next week's episode. And the week after that, we'll be dropping in an episode of First Edition, where Jeff has conducted an interview with a bookseller named Josh Cook from Porter Square Books in Boston. He has a new book out called The Art of Libromancy that's all about it's an essay collection about the kind of the modern state of independent bookselling. Really interesting book. Josh is a really interesting guy, and Porter Square, if you live in Boston or have had a chance to visit, is a really terrific store. That's going to be a great conversation, and that'll be dropped into this feed in lieu of a new episode here in a couple weeks. So y'all will hear from me at the top of that show, but we're just rounding out summer vacation season, taking care of having guests and other interesting things for you here. While Jeff is out, I'll be out for, I think, one episode in early September, and then we'll be, you know, back to school, back in our seats, saddled up for big fall book season. Before we get into the news of the week, let's take a break for our first sponsor.
Today's episode is brought to you by Flatiron Books, publisher of The Familiar by Leigh Bardugo. This is one I'm actually super excited about. I liked Leigh Bardugo's other adult fantasy books, and so I'm really looking forward to this one. It's set in the Spanish Golden Age during a time of high stakes political intrigue and glittering wealth. It follows Luzia, a servant in the household of an impoverished Spanish nobleman who reveals a talent for little miracles. Her social climbing mistress demands Luzia use her gifts to win over Madrid's most powerful players, but what begins as simple amusement takes a dangerous turn. Luzia will need to use every bit of her wit and will to survive, even the help of Guillén Santángel, an immortal familiar whose own secrets could prove deadly for them both. So The Familiar by Leigh Bardugo is on sale now. And like I said, it's a must read of the season. It's perfect for anyone who loves history, a little bit of magic, a lot of danger. You can get your copy now at LeighBardugoTheFamiliar.com. And thanks again to Flatiron Books, publisher of The Familiar by Leigh Bardugo, for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Amazon Publishing. So I got a story with a little Old West debauchery, if you want to get a little messy. So there is a city steeped in the Old West mess. And in the city, a reporter is following every lead to a dangerous place, one that could bring him glory and fame or end his life. New York Times bestselling author Robert Dugoni is back with a gripping new thriller of corruption, vice, and murder set in Depression-era Seattle. It's about a reporter covering a hot murder trial who soon learns nothing is what it seems. The story could make his career if he lives to write about it. You can learn more at amazon.com/A Killing on the Hill. So yes, A Killing on the Hill by Robert Dugoni is what you need to pick up if you are into some Depression era danger in Seattle. It's a city of big dreams and dark ambitions, and this reporter gets caught up in the muck. So make sure to check it out, and thanks again to Amazon Publishing for sponsoring this episode.
Okay, Vanessa, you as the managing editor have led, supported, created space for a really terrific years-long now set of coverage around censorship that Kelly, who's going to be here with me next week, has led the charge on and really become one of the leading voices, if not the leading voice, in coverage of book bans in both schools and public libraries over the last couple of years. Do you want to tell us about why we're extra proud of Kelly this week?
Yes, this is so exciting. I'm actually quite glad that I get to be on the show for this, even if it didn't work out, you know, the way it was supposed to. But so after a resolution was submitted by the Louisiana Association of School Librarians, the LASL, the American Association of School Librarians has commended Book Riot's weekly censorship roundup, which is by Kelly, essentially just recognizing it for being one of the, you know, outstanding programs, events, and products that are being recognized in this year for support of librarianship and just the school, you know, librarian profession as a whole. And this is, I'm so proud. I mean, honestly, that's the simple way to put it. I'm going to throw myself on the sword here and admit that many moons ago, when Kelly first suggested that we make this a regular roundup, I said, one of the stupidest things I think I've ever said at Book Riot was like, yeah, absolutely. But like, I wonder if we'll have enough to talk about.
And if only.
Like, what was I thinking? I mean, really, I guess I was trying to be hopeful for the future. But let's all, just really gather around and giving Kelly all of her props here. Because, yeah, this has been some really dogged coverage. Like, it's not easy work. It's time-consuming work. It's work that, because there really weren't a lot of other people doing it, that people have come to us both to recognize the work that we're doing. And by we, let me fully say it's mostly, you know, Kelly and also Danica, but also to like, okay, well, can you talk about this too? Can you talk about this too? Because the reality was that a lot of people weren't talking about it. And so folks, you know, sent a lot of it our way. And the parsing out of all of that information, you know, rounding it up so that people are fully aware of like what's going on in their communities, the communities at large, as well as actual like contextual analysis of all of that stuff, plus next steps and like toolkits and like how to fight censorship. It's not easy work. It's work that she does weekly and in a way that I don't think many people could, frankly. And it's, just really, really great to see her being recognized in this way.
I think dogged is the perfect word for it. The details of these things are both so like mundane and gross and familiar, but also there are enough little things that differentiate each one from each other one. Yes. And Kelly is able to find those and pull out why each one of these is significant, not just because anytime someone is trying to ban books, it's significant, but the very specific cases and how they fit into this bigger trend of, you know, the right wing, like the far right wing organizing and using censorship in schools and public libraries as a thin end of the wedge to have just more control over public education and the public conversation in general. You can see the weekly censorship roundup on the website on Book Riot. We'll put a link into the show notes. And you can also subscribe for free to Kelly's newsletter, Literary Activism, literaryactivism.substack.com, that goes out every week with deep dives into these stories, what we like to call Kelly Explains It All, and also ongoing links to places where you can get additional information and continue to educate yourself. So just super proud of Kelly. This is a very well-deserved commendation. And it also seems like there's really like no size of award that could really accurately convey how important this work is that she's doing. But we're glad to see it happen.
Yeah.
Very proud.
All right, Vanessa, where do you want to go here? We've got a trio of AI-related things we could talk about. We could get into the biggest publishing story of last week, or we could talk about some weird stuff happening on Book Talk.
Let's start with the AI stuff just to kind of get this out of the way, because wow.
Okay, yeah. So AI, I think this is going to be one of the ongoing stories of this year in publishing, yeah. Probably the next several years in publishing as well as in workplaces in general. But how technology that can generate words or, you know, crawl words from the internet and combine them in new ways is going to impact an industry that's built on putting words into novel orders and selling them to people. It's just really a giant ongoing question. So the first of our stories here is that AI-generated travel guidebooks have just like taken over Amazon.
They have.
This, I guess, shouldn't be terribly surprising. Nonfiction, I think, is much more ripe for disruption by AI or interruption or whatever you want to call it, because it doesn't require the same, necessarily the same kind of creative generation that fiction takes. Like, you are repeating facts, you are putting them together in new ways. But one of the very first use examples that I heard of when ChatGPT came out was like, you can ask it to give you an itinerary for a trip, because there are so many suggested itineraries for popular places already on the internet that when the bots go out and they crawl the internet, there's just a rich field of material that they can use to, you know, recombine it into, here's how you should spend 5 days in Utah going around the national parks, which like is an itinerary that I asked ChatGPT to put together for me. And then I compared it to my Lonely Planet guidebook, and it was pretty similar. But these, you can see at the top of this New York Times piece, there's a photo collage of these covers, like of the book covers for all kinds of places. Yeah. They look like a marriage of what you would expect to see on like a Lonely Planet or a Rick Steves cover. And also they do have a flavor of like someone just learned how to Photoshop.
Yes, that.
So what's happening here is somebody, Mike Steves is the fake author name of at least several of these. Like, kudos, Mike Steves. That was creative. Is having AI generate travel books, and they're listing them on Amazon with presumably fake reviews. They're listing them for cheaper than the, like, Rick Steves goes for $25.49 was in one of the examples, and the Mike Steves version was listed at $16.99, this travel guide for France. And so shoppers are looking at a bunch of great reviews. They're looking at this cheaper price point, and they are buying books that turn out to be disappointing.
Yeah. My brain is going all over the place here. There is a point, part of me that looks at these and goes, okay, maybe I'm being too snobby and they do actually look like some of the travel guides that I've seen. The other part of my brain is like, this absolutely looks like somebody hopped into Canva. And like, I guess maybe if you're used to looking at this stuff the way we are, you're like, oh, this might look a little sus. But if you're the average person, like the person who's mentioned in this particular piece that we're looking at from the New York Times, who's not maybe as practiced in that sort of thing, like, it is a bummer, because the deeper we get into these, you know, Rebecca's experience might have been relatively quote unquote positive, you know, when looking up like your itinerary, but it sounds like the contents of these books was like very, very cutty, pasty, like you should go to the Eiffel Tower.
Right.
In a way that's a bummer for people who spent money, right? Like, yeah.
Yeah. So the New York Times piece is by Seth Kugel and Stephen Hiltner. And it opens with an anecdote from a woman named Amy Kolsky, who is 53. And she's saying that the book comes, the Mike Steves Guide to France shows up, and it, quote, seemed like the guy just went on the internet, copied a whole bunch of information from Wikipedia, and just pasted it in. And that, my friends, is how generative AI works.
Yes.
It goes on the internet, it copies information, and then it functionally pastes it in or changes a few of the word orders. It puts them together in new combinations. So it feels that way because it is that way. You know, AI apps can produce text, they can produce fake pictures. There's all kinds of complicated stuff here going on. And the FTC has not come anywhere close to offering helpful regulation that can protect consumers in this situation. So the question here really is, I think, two-pronged of, is Amazon going to do anything about these? Should it? Yes. Will it? Shruggy man.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, you know, pieces like this from the New York Times, I think, go a ways toward educating consumers about what to look out for. But we're still, it's still so early in the life of generative AI. And, you know, like often when we talk about a new technology, I start thinking about the gap between my openness and familiarity to something like this and like what it would take for my parents to like be aware of AI. Like if my dad went looking for a travel guide to France, he's a smart guy. He lives in the world, all those things. But would he look at these covers and think anything looked fishy? Would he know that Mike Steves is suspiciously close to Rick Steves?
Yeah, because that's the other part, right? Is that his bio, if you read it, it sounds like incredibly legit. Like if you don't know anything about Rick Steves, like it is well written enough that you're like, oh, that, you know, touts how this guy's like a very well-known travel writer who's received lots of accolades and has, you know, written for some pretty prominent travel stuff. So if you're just your average person,
right,
you look and at like, that, like, okay, cool.
And if the New York Times or the Today Show or like, you know, big mainstream news weren't telling people, hey, this is stuff you have to look out for, I don't think it's reasonable to expect, as you were saying, like the average consumer to know yet that this is a thing they need to be on the lookout for. So this is a big, interesting piece in the Times. You can dive way into it, especially if you're thinking like, what are some ways that I can tell? Like they go into helping you identify, like, what are some tells of a fake review? What are some tells of a fake, you know, AI generated image? There's stuff like if there's two people in the picture and they're like, they're supposed to be, you know, talking to each other or touching, you can look and see, are they not quite touching?
Yeah.
Like, there's all kinds of stuff that like I would never have thought
put together.
Of. It is really interesting. And this, you know, this kind of reporting is going to be, I think, the first wave in consumer education about this until we have some kind of hopefully useful regulation to prevent it. And you know, there's probably no preventing people attempting to use technologies in this way. So it will come down to regulators either, you know, penalizing folks for profiting off of it or really retailers like Amazon deciding that it's not something that they want to be affiliated with, which given the story, this next story about Jane Friedman does not make me terribly hopeful for Amazon's activity. Why don't you tell us what's happening there?
Yeah. So as Rebecca mentioned, there's a woman named Jade Friedman who essentially has had to have or has asked Amazon to remove a ton of books that were generated by AI, but for sale under her name from the site. You can read more about this in this piece in The Guardian by Ella Creamer. So yes, there is a this woman named Jane Friedman who has sold and written several books about the publishing industry. I think Publishing 101 and one that's about like the business of being a writer, I believe. And was made privy by another person, basically. They're like, hey, have you, there's some other books on the internet that say that you wrote them and they look a little different. And so, of course, you know, she did indeed find out that this was the case, that a bunch of books that have been falsely attributed to her that have very long SEO capture titles that are basically like how to write a book and make lots of money off of it in X many days that, yeah, are not written by her, period, right? So there's that. But then, yeah, that are AI generative. And obviously not, she feels ripped off. She says it's not, you know, fair for folks to come to what she had, you know, she's put a lot of work into the books that she's written and to now have other stuff attributed to her is obviously unfair. And so she's had to go to Amazon and say like, hey, take this down. I believe they did, but it's yeah, speaking to what Rebecca said earlier about, like, of course, in all the pieces that we have about AI that I'm staring at, there is, of course, a fully throated section from Amazon saying, like, no, we don't allow this. Of course we don't. This is against our policies, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But
is where I'm landing on this. The but is that Amazon did remove it, but not the first time.
The first time, you're right. Yes.
The first time that Friedman complained about this to Amazon and asked them to remove the books, they told her that they would not because she hadn't trademarked her name.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about that part.
The books did end up being taken down from both Amazon and Goodreads, which listeners of this show know is owned by Amazon. Oh, and Friedman suspects that it's because she spoke out about this on social media. I suspect that she is right. And she's calling here for Amazon to develop a procedure of some kind for reporting this activity where someone is trying to profit off of someone else's name, and for Amazon to create a way to verify authorship. Jane Friedman, as you were saying, Vanessa, is a well-known industry expert. She's been blogging about the publishing industry since 2009, was one of the first professional blogs I started following. We've talked about her insights on this show many times over the last decade. And I am sure that this is happening in every other industry, you know, that there you know, music experts and technology experts and anybody else who is a well-known name who has a ton of material online. Because like, that's one of the reasons that she was vulnerable and she recognizes it here. She's been blogging since 2009.
Yep.
That is a ton of publicly available material for AI models to be trained on. And to be really clear, those AI models, like, nobody sat down at OpenAI, like, let's just use ChatGPT as the example, and was like, dear ChatGPT, please go train yourself on Jane Friedman's blog specifically. But it's on the open internet. You know, Book Riot is on the open internet. If you go ask ChatGPT to give you a summary of Gone Girl, there's a non-zero chance that some of that summary comes from something somebody wrote on Book Riot, something somebody wrote on the New York Times website or any number of other public places. It's just the deal. If it's out there publicly, currently, AI models can train themselves on it. And you're especially vulnerable, I think, in this combination of a well-known, respected name. So the question really is, like, who are the who's doing shenanigans here that's paying close enough attention to a specific industry to know the name of a respected person and then do an AI-generated book or 5 or 12 on that same kind of material and use that person's name. It's kind of – it's weird to think about that happening. But there we are.
I let me be the last one to sit here and, quote-unquote, defend Amazon from a lot of things. But I am sitting around thinking about the people whose job it is to figure out what to do in this particular situation, especially since, you know, part of their whole appeal for folks who do want to choose the path towards self-publishing is that they make it easy to just go on and do all that. And obviously, and having to add a layer of protection for established authors to ask people to actually verify their identity in a meaningful way is going to be a thing that drastically changes the current model. And like the scale at which they're having to do this is just like,
the only kind of similar system I've experienced was like booking an Airbnb for somewhere out of the US and having to submit a photo of my, like, you know, the photo page on my passport to Airbnb to prove who I was and that I was, like, you know, legally allowed to leave this country and go into that country. And I think we might be moving towards something like that, or that Amazon might need to be considering something like that if they are looking for meaningful verification of here's, you know, who this person is. This person, first of all, is real.
Yeah. Like,
does Mike Steves exist?
The photo of Mike Steves, I implore you to please go find for yourself.
Well, it also feels like, I mean, that's turtles all the way down, right? Like, is whoever is sitting in their basement generating AI travel books, are they also generating an author photo of a fake Mike Steves?
With a, what is apparently a partially formed earring?
Yeah.
There's just this like floaty piece of what I thought was flesh and was extremely grossed out by. And I know, anyway, yeah, this is a whole, like, turtles all down and into the crust of the earth. But
super, just weird and tricky stuff. Probably not the last we'll see of this, but I guess on the top line, you know, it's not great that Amazon wouldn't take it down the first time around. Mm-hmm. It's weird if the expectation is that you have to have trademarked your name.
Yeah.
That's like, hopefully that's not where we go in terms of regulation. That's also tricky if you have a common name. Like, if your name is John Smith, you better just hope you're the first one to get to the trademark if that that's what it depends on to be able to protect your books on Amazon. But, you know, they got it down after she made it public. And hopefully that is a lesson to them to be, you know, moving on something like this. You would think, especially from the Goodreads side, like fake reviews are a problem. Amazon mm-hmm. has taken steps both on Amazon and Goodreads, especially Amazon, to indicate Amazon. Verified yeah. purchases. And they'll show you if a review is being given by someone who has actually bought the book or the sweatpants or whatever it is that you're thinking about buying. That seems to go, you know, away here, except like, if you're trying to scam everyone, you could, you know, launch a bunch of email addresses and buy a bunch of copies of your own fake book and write a bunch of fake emails. Like, this also feels very complex. I wouldn't want to be the Amazon person trying to figure out how to do it. But Amazon does employ, you know, some of the best tech workers in the world. So
yeah, because apparently there's also a loophole wherein, like, if you offer it as an ebook and you're offering it for free, like, that counts as a purchase. So that can be a verified reader. Like, yeah, I do not envy these people's jobs, but yeah. That's why you get paid the big bucks, people.
Enjoy. Gonna be interesting to see how that goes. And then it may be the most obviously misguided use of what I'm not even sure is AI, but AI adjacent stuff. This story was over just about as fast as it started last week. A new website called Prosecraft launched. It is now taken down. So you'll have to read this Gizmodo piece by Linda Codega and just listen to us talk about it if you want to know about it. But the TLDR is a guy named Benji Smith, who runs another website called Shakespeare, but it's Shaxpir. Take that in.
Oof. Yeah. Breath. Okay. Got it.
It created this voice, website called Prosecraft, that into which he had uploaded the full text of over 25,000 books. So first, like, this is Benji's first misstep, because those books are fully copyrighted material. Fully. And his idea was, upload all this material, create this library of data, and then if you are a wannabe author, and let's say you want to write a book like, I'm just looking at this top example, the first tweet here is a book called Hunger's As Old As This Land by Zach Rosenberg. So let's say you loved Hunger's As Old As This Land, and you want to write a book that's similar to it. Prosecraft analyzed the text of a book for the total words, the vividness of the language, whatever that means, the use of passive voice, the use of non-ly adverbs, which is really interesting.
Ly
adverbs, all adverbs, other stuff, all kinds of other like nitty gritty analysis of what are the words that go into this book. And then you could upload your text of your novel and it would say, here's how you need to change. Like, your book is only in the 25th percentile of vividness, but Hunger's As Old As This Land is in the 80th percentile of vividness. So make your language more vivid. How do you do that? Who knows?
Orders of vivid magnitude.
Prosecraft would tell you how to do that. Now, Benji Smith launches Prosecraft. He starts tweeting about it. Authors like very quickly discover that their books have been uploaded to this and are very quickly upset because they didn't give permission for their copyrighted material to be used here. Benji Smith takes it down. Prosecraft no longer exists. That has run its course. But what I want to talk about, Vanessa, is...
Actually, I'm like, where are you going to go? Go ahead. No, go ahead.
Where do you want to go?
I just was really dying at the tweets wherein, of course, authors are like, yeah, no, take my ish the F down. And his response to one Jeff Vandermeer, like Jeff Vandermeer is like, yeah. If you don't want your book included, just email me at Benji@Shakespeare.com with a link to your book and I'll remove it. And he's like, no, take all of my books down, you weirdo. I'm not going to email you like, and these are this is the Southern Reach trilogy. Like, that just tickled me that he was like, yeah, just send a quick little email and it'll be fine. But I could go on for a lot of this stuff. I was just like, my brother in Christ, what are we doing here?
That is my central question. Like, this seems to me to actually be kind of in line with a lot of the other reasons that I'm not that worried about AI ruining publishing, because it fundamentally misunderstands like how especially fiction works. The idea that if you want to write a book like Gone Girl, what you need to do is make it have the same number of words and the same percentage of adverbs that don't end in L-Y and the same amount of vivid language, whatever the hell that means.
Yeah.
And then you will be like if you could match your prose to the same stats that Gone Girl had, then you would have a book like Gone Girl. Then you would be a writer like Gillian Flynn.
Which is just fundamentally whacked. Like, it's not.
Right. Like, writing is craft. There are certainly skills that folks need to learn. You need to have a command of grammar and understand vocabulary and how the English language functions. Yes. But writing is a craft. And to try to reduce any piece of art. This is like if I uploaded a portrait of my mom, which would be terrible. I have zero artistic skills. And it was like, what Same. You need in order to be similar to the Mona Lisa is more muted tones, you know, like less eye contact. And like, there's no way.
Yeah.
Yeah. It would, I'm not even sure it would be marginally better if I made those changes. It would just be bad in a different way.
Yeah, just slightly less bad, creatively bad.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Like, if you start off, you know, far away from Gillian Flynn and you make all the changes, I think you end up with a book that is still just as different from Gillian Flynn, just in different ways. Like, now you've used the same number of adverbs that she has.
Great.
And yeah. Like, technology, people imposing ideas of technology onto what art does, I think actually really protects how art functions. Like, this gives me, I was already not super worried about at least what this current round of AI technology was going to do to like, to real, quote unquote, like to the real quality of books and reading. You know, like these AI travel guidebooks are not great. Rick Steves' job is still safe if you want a good one, you know?
Yeah.
Like, he's doing okay. Gillian Flynn, gonna be okay. And I think I'm just waiting for like the first time someone even comes close to getting it right on how to use something like this for a tool for writers or authors. But this ain't it.
This is not it. It's just like the part that you were just uploading people's copyrighted work, full stop, is like we could have just ended there. Like, I don't understand the rest of it. I am admittedly like, I am of two minds. I am both a super curmudgeon about anything that has to do with art in this way, and so I know that I get on my little high horse about the fact that I find AI super annoying in a lot more ways than not. But I also have like colleagues who have been like, look, I use ChatGPT to make my life easier in these XYZ ways, which like I understand that there are really helpful parts of a lot of the technology that we touch in daily life that has nothing to do with art, that do make people's lives easier. And so I understand that. And I also am similarly not worried about the quality, because I just don't think you can ever distill a craft in that way. You can hit all the markers, you can have the adjectives and the adverbs and stuff, but it's just such a personal, creative endeavor that I don't think you can whittle it down. And if you get close, like, I guess we'll see. I don't like the deluge and like the work that this creates for people, like the work of having to undo it and like keep, you know, so now somebody has to track down all this stuff on Amazon because there's that flooding of the market. Like, what are submissions going to look like? Which I think I've said on this show too. Like, what if you're getting flooded by this? That part, I just, again, I'm such a curmudgeon about. But as far as the actual art itself, I'm not worried about that. Like you said, I think we're a long ways from being able to duplicate, you know, Jeff Vandermeer's voice.
It reminds me of in my freshman English class in high school, we had read The Great Gatsby and then we had read one of the Hemingways. And I think that's pretty typical. Like, pretty typically Fitzgerald and Hemingway are paired against each other in a compare contrast situation of Hemingway, you know, very spare, short sentences. Mm-hmm. Fitzgerald, you know, things run on a little more and there's flowery language and blah, blah, blah. And then one of the assignments was like, pick one of these topics and write a short story in the style of either Fitzgerald or Hemingway. And like, ninth graders did better than AI would have done, I think, based on use short sentences, use adjective.
Be spare. Don't be spare. Right. Yeah.
But those inputs are not enough, whether you're putting them into ninth graders or an AI situation to generate a good work of art.
Yeah.
It's...
Agreed.
Yeah, just not great. All right, let's take our next sponsor break and then we will talk about big news.
Today's episode is brought to you by Song of the Silk's Realms by Judy I. Lin. Xu Wei is a talented young musician who was orphaned at a young age. Her soul family is a kindly uncle, but then her uncle is killed, and she is, of course, devastated. With no family and no patron, Xu Wei is facing the possibility of a lifetime of servitude playing the qin. Then one night, she is unexpectedly called to perform for the enigmatic Duke Meng. He surprises Xu Wei further with an irresistible offer. Serve as a musician in residence at his manor for 1 year, and he'll set her free of her indenture. But the Duke's motives become increasingly more sus when he and Xu Wei barely survive an attack by a nightmarish monster. It's like, what? What's going on here? So this book is a sweeping epic romantasy that follows a talented young musician who is swept away to the celestial realm by an enigmatic young duke. And who doesn't want to be swept away to the celestial realm by an enigmatic young duke? She's living all our dreams, honestly. Make sure to check out the new book. And thanks again to Song of the Six Realms by Judy I. Lin for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Steve Aoki's HeroQuest at your local bookstore or online at HeroQuest.com. And catch Steve live on the Heavenly Hell Tour. HeroQuest is a graphic novel that is the story of a genetically augmented metahuman named Hero who travels into the multiverse 400 years into the future to save Earth from a disaster it cannot avoid. It has everything from mutants to robots to zombies to aliens, witches, and more. It's a quest for 10 rings of tremendous power from 10 different worlds that will be needed to save our world from certain disaster. It's an epic journey that will require the hero named Hiro to be cursed to save the lives of billions on Earth. It's a story of heroism, wonder, betrayal, and finally, revelation. This is the hero's journey. This is Hiro's quest. So the story was imagined by the mind of Steve Aoki and written by New York Times bestselling author Jim Kruger and Steve Aoki. So make sure to check it out. And this episode comes thanks again to Steve Aoki's HeroQuest at your local bookstore or online at HeroQuest.com. And catch Steve live on the Heavenly Hell Tour.
Okay, so big news of the week. We really kicked off last week with this news that Simon & Schuster had been sold. Paramount agreed to sell Simon & Schuster to a private equity firm called KKR for $1.62 billion. Long journey for Simon & Schuster after the years-long attempt to sell itself to Penguin Random House was nixed by the DOJ. They took a $200 million kill fee for that. That deal was originally supposed to be, I think, $2.1 billion. So Paramount's still coming out with a slightly lower valuation here, even if you count that $200 million kill fee. But $1.62 billion, not a small amount of dollars. What we know so far, this is not KKR's first rodeo in books and publishing. They previously acquired a company called RB Media that did a lot of audiobook publishing. They very successfully built up that company and sold it off in a way that when KKR took over RB Media, employees got equity stake in the company. Mm-hmm. And then when KKR spun RB Media off after several years, that was such a profitable sale that all of the employees got bonuses, sometime up to the equivalent of two times their annual salary. Oof. Yeah. So KKR has done this successfully. Now, KKR, like most private equity, also has some shady stuff. There is a book called Barbarians at the Gate that you can read about, you know, some of the less savory things that KKR has participated in. They also were the acquirers and spin downers of Toys R Us. So it's not always acquire something, make it better, spin it off. But it looks to me like they are going the positive direction with this Simon & Schuster acquisition. They're keeping most of the top brass at Simon & Schuster. John Karp, who's the CEO at SNS, says they plan to invest in us and make us greater than we already are. What more could a publishing company want? We don't know if Simon & Schuster employees are going to get that same like equity offer that RB Media employees got, but it looks to me like KKR sees value. Simon & Schuster made a lot of money last year and over the last couple of years, and that KKR wants to capitalize on that. Now, it's not always all good news, though, when acquisitions happen. So I want to give you a minute here for your take, Vanessa.
Yeah, I reread this piece probably like three or four times just because I was trying to get my brain around all the different elements. Yeah, my portion of this was definitely knowing the less savory parts that KKR was bringing to the table until I read this. It's complicated, right? Like, on the one mm-hmm. hand, a company that is not already, you know, obviously in the publishing industry means that we're not further consolidating the publishing industry, which is yes. already very small because of how few publishing houses like currently exist in this form. The chance at giving employees that type of equity is could be like a game-changing model that I'm like interested to look at. The fact that it isn't, again, going back to the publishing thing, company means that they are potentially anyway not looking at as many consolidation consequences that you would normally see mm-hmm. when two publishing houses merge, as far as like needing to let people go and restructure and lay off, etc. And if they are going, like, I think RB Media is also, I didn't know this, the company behind, I believe, Overdrive, they mm-hmm. Said in the piece. And so, you know, Overdrive and Libby and all of its affiliates have obviously done some major stuff for digital reading in libraries yes. and schools. There's so much going on and at stake here that I'm just, I guess, really curious to see what the like next steps are. I my brain breaks a teeny bit. It's kind of having to weigh it all.
I think, you know, I think that's like the right kind of response to something that is as big and as complicated as this, because it's the easiest thing is a one note reaction.
Yeah.
And the one note reaction to a private equity acquisition of just about anything is like, oh my God, equity is evil.
Indeed.
And those headlines are certainly going around. We've talked in recent weeks about, you know, the criticism and activism that exist inside the publishing industry of the publishing industry that are really mm-hmm. criticisms of capitalism
yeah.
and capitalist forces. And there's not a version of this sale of Simon and Schuster to some entity that I think makes everybody happy.
Oh, absolutely not.
It is better. I think that we can almost universally agree that this is a better or more desired outcome than seeing Simon and Schuster be sold to HarperCollins, which was also in the bidding
yep.
here. Oof. That would have been, as you were saying, further consolidation. We'd be down to the big four in publishing rather than the big five. It would have almost definitely led to layoffs, fewer opportunities for authors. Now, like, this is not a perfect solution. There are no perfect solutions. And KKR is in the money business. So they're probably also going to be looking at profitability. And unless you're going to pay people less or somehow make books make more money, you probably have to pay fewer people. So yep. I would imagine that we will see some layoffs at Simon & Schuster over time. When Jeff and I had this conversation the first time around last week, one of the things that we were kicking around is like, if you wanted to avoid layoffs, but also somehow become more profitable, what else could you do? And like, one of my things was like, well, they could, you know, you could really like take a red pen to book advances. Like most yeah. books that get $1 million plus advances don't earn out. What does a deeper analysis of those financial risks look like? If they were going to continue doing big advances like that, then you could squeeze the midlist. You could publish fewer midlist books, and nobody really wants that to happen. We don't want fewer books out in the world. We don't want less opportunity for authors. But and like an anecdote that I've told probably a dozen times on this show over the years was having sat in a sales meeting with a senior editor several years ago and going through a catalog and then kind of like I remember pointing to a title and being like, well, that's really interesting. Could we talk about an ad campaign around that book? And them saying, well, we don't have any budget for that one. And I must have made some kind of face. And the person was like, well, sometimes we just have to let junior editors acquire something so they have something to work on.
Yep.
And like that is one of the more cynical responses. But like folks in publishing want to publish books. Yep. And they want to publish books that might not be profitable. They want to publish things that they know won't be profitable. I don't think it's necessarily bad to have somebody like put on the green visor and start going through the finances with an outside perspective, because publishing has done things the same way for a really long time. And if the activists inside and around publishing are to be believed, that way is broken. So yeah. what are some other ways?
Yeah.
I think there are a lot of pieces to this. Like the other thing I've been really thinking about and that I told Jeff last week was I went and Googled, you know, I was trying to find like, has someone done a deep dive on how publishing has changed in the 10 years since Penguin and Random House merged. And first of all, it's been 10 years.
The face I just made. I was like, what?
Yeah, that happened in 2013. So welcome to how time functions. Wow. I couldn't find anything. And I don't know, you know, I don't want to take absence of proof as proof of absence.
Sure.
We know that there have been changes. We know that there have been layoffs. Maybe that data is just too hard to get for someone to say, here's how many books they published each year when they were Penguin and Random House separately. Here's what's happened now that they're together. What I do know is there are still too many books. There are more books than anybody can read in any given year. And so I'm personally not terribly concerned that any decrease in the amount of books published that KKR, you know, institutes with Simon & Schuster as a way to make it more profitable will be something that readers feel. If we're talking about the state of being a reader, will this impact your life as a reader? Probably not, is my first approximation of a guess.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, speaking as, I mean, yeah, somebody who constantly looks through new releases to have to talk about them on a podcast, like like you said, there's just more books out there than you could ever calculate in your brain. Like, I do not think as a reader, I'm like very positive that you would not feel that difference, but no. Folks with a certain attachment and awe to the life of publishing probably don't like want to hear that, and I get it, but again, complicated.
Yeah. And like, for as long as art and commerce are mixed, it's going to be complicated.
Absolutely. Yep. That is the perfect distillation.
We will take one last break and then we're going to talk about some weirdness on Book Talk.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You know, Vanessa, I love you, and I am a little bit sad that I'm not getting to make Jeff have this conversation with me.
I am myself, like, I'm upset that I'm the one here to talk to you about this, mostly because, like, the idea of getting to listen to Jeff talk about it is a thing I feel I've robbed the people of. So I'm so sorry. But here we are.
Okay. Yeah. So why don't you tell us what happened with Hockey Romance readers? What's going on?
So I'm looking at a different piece than Rebecca was looking at because I accidentally closed that tab, I think. So I'm looking at one from The Cut by Andrea González Ramírez that is, I'm just going to read you this title, The Smutty Hockey Drama Melting Down Book Talk. And that is essentially where we are at. So for those who don't know, hockey romance is a whole thing. It's a big kind of subset of the romance genre. We've got some really great pieces on the site about it that we can link to by Jess Pride and I think Trisha as well, that are all about like what's the genre about. Here's the books about it. It is a thriving subgenre. Folks love them some hockey smut, and it goes everywhere from, you know, runs the gamut on spiciness, etc. Great. So the issue here is that specifically, there's a player on the Seattle Kraken named Alex Wenberg, who became like a TikTok darling, to put it very cleanly, when one TikToker in particular made like a video and that then blew up and made lots of people essentially do the same thing about how hot this guy is, and essentially sort of, what's the word they use in this piece? Like, face claimed him, I think is the term I keep seeing as like the face cringing of their hockey road. But I when I looked, I didn't want to look it up because I was scared what it would do to my algorithm and like safety of my work owned computer.
So valid.
But that's basically what it was. And it got to the point where, you know, so in this video, she's saying some things that I will not say on this podcast. Mm-mm. And I really wish Jeff could.
It's a family show, my friends.
Family show. But that are very, very sexual in nature. And it blew up. So the other complicated piece of this is that it blew up to the point where the Seattle Kraken noticed it and also was sort of capitalizing it, to be fair. Like, they were also posting, like, very slowed down, like, edited videos of this player, Alex Wenberg, that, and then, you know, included, like, the book talk hashtag. And I think even converted the account at one point to say, like, mostly book talk, because they were fully aware that the hockey romance loving internet was all about this guy. And his wife, too, was aware of it. And they were, like, okay with it for a bit, because it was all sort of in good fun at first. Seattle Kraken invites this person, the TikToker, to their games, like to the Stanley Cup. They get her like a jersey. I mean, it's a whole thing. Like, everybody's kind of in on the joke. And then the stuff that's being said about this guy
and then
gets really gross really fast.
Yeah.
I'm going to let you chime in a little.
Okay. Here. Yeah. Oh, you're going to make me do this part. Thank you.
Hashtag crack my back.
I mean, you did say face claiming for us, so yeah. you've done your
I did.
Work for the day.
I did it.
It's so early still on the West Coast, and you just get to be done now.
It's great.
So what happened here is this went from good-natured-ish, like, we love these books, and here's this real-life hot hockey player that we're imagining as the face of these books that we love, into hockey romance fans going to hockey games. And shouting, I mean, the things that they were shouting are sexual harassment. Like, they are the kinds of things that are, like, stereotypical comments, like, of the flavor that in the most stereotypical arrangement possible, like, a construction worker would shout at a woman walking down the street. Like, none of it is.
Which is what his wife points out, right?
None of it's acceptable. And they were making these comments, like, on his Instagram, on her Instagram, really, like, crossed the breach from a playful, you know, sort of fandom appreciation of these books and this person into, like, they crossed the breach from fiction to reality. And I think did not consider that the people on the other end were real people. Like, I have a lot of just like, oh, can we have some dignity here, ladies?
Yeah.
Reactions to this. Like, it's a very small group of people. You know, romance is a huge community with a lot of diverse and, like, niche sub communities within it. This is a very small group of people that are behaving badly, but they're behaving really, really badly. And the soapbox I got on about this when Jeff and I were talking, he was like, he thought he was going to make it out of the episode without having to talk about this. And I was like, no, I need my soapbox. I think you're on the soapbox with me, Vanessa, is that romance has spent decades defending itself from these very wrongheaded public perceptions that there was, like, something wrong with romance readers.
Yeah.
You know, that, like, if you were into that kind of book, something was going sideways. And, like, that's not true. Romance is wonderful. It's valid. The vast majority of the people who read and enjoy it are healthy and normal and all of those things. And they understand the divide between fiction and reality. Like, that's one of the common, like, people who are trying to kind of straw man about the quote unquote problems with romance. One of the common things they toss up is like, oh, it gives readers, like, unrealistic expectations about what relationships are like and what sex is like and all these things. And, like, they can't tell the difference between fiction and reality. And I think really these folks just got carried away. I would bet these readers really do know the difference between fiction and reality, but they were having fun. And they took it too far. And then when they got called out on it, they doubled down. I'm like, no, I'm going to be here and I'm going to say these things and I'm going to, like, defend myself. And this would be unfortunate and really unacceptable no matter what genre or what community it happened in. Yeah. But I extra hate to see it happen to romance, because romance is the genre that has spent a lot of its life defending itself against these kinds of ideas that, like, this is what the readers are like. Like, everybody just be cool. Let's not make sexual comments to people that they haven't consented to participate in.
And it's super weird that it was happening, like, in person and, like, the pictures of their kids and stuff. It's just be cool, be chill. What are you doing?
Lines were crossed. This is not okay. And the thing that I really kept coming back to is, if we flipped the genders here, and these are heteronormative interactions, so I'm going to go that way with my gender flip.
Yeah.
And we were talking about like a bunch of male readers who enjoyed women's soccer romances showing up at a women's soccer game, shouting sexual remarks. We wouldn't have to think twice about how this was a problem and this was harassment and it was unacceptable. And like that, it just remains unacceptable no matter what. Romance is about empowering readers, particularly empowering women. And this is not what empowerment looks like. This is not what we've been working for with feminism, friends.
That was the part that I felt really bummed about when I was online, like as I was watching as this was sort of playing out, is that like, you know, the discourse quickly went from the very like valid recognition that this is sexual harassment, that like once someone it's about consent, right? Like once someone says, hey, stop, like the answer is to stop, like, et cetera. But it quickly devolved into the piling on to, like, can we all, I kept seeing tweets that, like, can we all just agree that, you know, romance readers are, is all just thinly veiled, you know, pornographic material, et cetera. And like, granted, is there erotica and are there lots of romances that, you know, tend to the more like sexually explicit? Absolutely. And that is perfect and fine and valid. And then there's not. And it quickly just became like a, yeah, a tear down of everything that romance and romance readers are, that felt so backwards from where I thought or hoped we were getting. It was, and then the doubling. There's so many pieces of this. It was like, this could have been like a cool, fun, easy little thing. And y'all still could have been showing up with your heart-eyed emojis over this, you know, ostensibly attractive man. But you had to make it weird. And Lord knows I wouldn't want someone coming into my job at Book Riot, opening the door, being like, hey, you know, blah, blah, blah. Like, no, that's weird.
So, it is weird. Yeah. And I understand why the hockey teams tried to capitalize on this. Like, hockey has a hard time attracting women to their fandom. And so it was, I think, pretty exciting when even like 15 or 30 women from TikTok started showing up at some of these hockey games. But I think that was a mistake for them to try to get involved. And when Jeff and I talked about this in the recording that died, he was recalling there's an early episode of The West Wing where Josh finds out that there are women in an online forum talking about him in a flattering way, like kind of writing sexy fanfic about him. And he goes in and tries to participate in it and learns quickly in a pretty similar way to this. That you don't want to do that. So I think there's a lesson here for, like, this time around it was a hockey team, but there's a lesson here for anybody who, like, if you win the weird lottery where folks online are like reading a book that's adjacent to your business and somehow they start patronizing your business as well, I think you just say thank you and you take their dollars and you hope it doesn't get weird, and you definitely don't try to stoke it, because that will just help it get weird faster.
That's please learn this lesson, wider internet.
This was a spicy one, but it mostly left me with a lot of like, I'm your, the internet's disappointed mom feelings, you know, like, let's do better. Well, before we get out of here, Vanessa, let's do a little front list foyer. Have you been reading anything lately that you want to shout out?
Yes, I, for being on like a weird little slump, feel like in the last like 2 weeks, I just suddenly read a ton of books, which is great. I just finished Wayward, which is still front list. I think it actually came out a couple months ago, but by Amelia Hart. And it's like a witchy intergenerational story that goes back to like witch trial-y type times and then comes forward. And it's sort of about a legacy of magic and witchcraft and like oppression of women and toxic masculinity. I don't know, the cover had a crow on it, and so that's really all it took for me. But I thought it was gonna be like a little bit lighter than it was, and it ended up being this really deep and like beautiful exploration of like the ways that women defend, like, like women's, not just friendship, but just the, like, again, the analysis of what witchcraft like means and like why women have been painted as witches since, you know, time immemorial. So it was really, really fun. And then I just read The Trap by Katherine Ryan Howard, which is definitely one of those that you don't want to read at night. And if you're a woman, like, is definitely not going to, like, give you I am safe in the world vibes.
As Barbie puts it, there's an undertone of violence.
There is an undertone of violence. Yeah, the book opens with this really, like, terrifying little passage. But it's essentially about a woman whose sister disappeared many years ago. So she's, like, one of our characters is trying to find her. There's another woman who works at a missing persons unit who may now have found a discovery about this girl and a bunch of other missing girls. And then there is a serial killer narrating, like his justifications for things, like, and you can tell the you quickly find out that he's telling these things to a woman who is in his trunk. And it gets, yeah, it is not a happy book. It is a thriller, though. Like, Catherine Ryan Howard's books are very page-turny. And if you need something that will just, like, yeah, get you in that place, this is it. And then that just lastly, it's phenomenal. And it's a really good listen on audio, too, if you have audio.
Oh, my God, then, a scary book on audio. No.
Jamie Canaves told me, like, don't listen to this, like, right before you go to bed. And I stupidly was like, it's fine.
We
and
never learn.
Maybe 30 seconds and I stopped. And instead, in the morning, just because it definitely was making me do the look back and forth, like, is my door locked kind of thing.
Is there anyone under my bed?
Correct. So there's that. But it is really, really good, as is her backlist pick, 56 Days. And then lastly, I just started reading Lone Women by Victor Laval, and I'm just super jazzed because of the Changeling adaptation that's coming. I loved and was equally terrified by the Changeling, and so I've finally started Lone Women, and it is really great so far. I'm not too far into it, but man, if you're not reading Victor Laval.
Jeff has said that's his favorite fiction experience of the year so far.
Really? Ooh, that's great. I wonder, has he read The Changeling? That feels like a thing he couldn't read.
I'm not sure. I don't think he has. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, that's what I'm. Lots of stuff going on over here.
Nice. Yeah. I am living in my personal Venn diagram with a book called The Sullivanians by Alexander Steele, or Still, it's Stille, which is about, it's basically like not true crime. It feels like in the Bad Blood vein, but it is about a psychotherapy cult that sprang up in New York's Upper West Side in the 60s and 70s that turned into like a weirdo sex cult, because they always turn into weirdo sex cults.
Oh, I'm writing that down. Okay. Cool.
But it's like these psychotherapists who were inspired by the work of Harry Stack Sullivan. That's why it's called the Sullivanians, but Harry Stack Sullivan had no part of it. They found this community group, basically. They start this community group where everyone is in the same kind of therapy with them. And then if you've been in therapy long enough, you can become a trainee and start seeing other clients. None of this is like sanctioned by any governing body of psychotherapy or psychology or anything. It's just all coming down from the higher ups, where they encourage everyone to, like, the whole thing is about, like, we heal and grow in community. So you need to, like, live in community with other people that are going through the same therapy. So there are all these, like, same-sex apartments, people living with four or six or eight other people who are participating in this therapy. And then it builds into, like, oh, it also turns out that your family is evil, especially your parents. So you should cut yourself off from them, but also you should make sure to get lots of money from them to help this organization do things. It goes on for like decades. It lasted until 1991. And Steele has interviewed people who were involved with it early on and at the weirdest points, and then who stuck around for like the last decade as it was petering out. And it is just, I mean, like, it's wild in kind of the predictable ways that a story about a cult is wild, but the specifics of any story like this are the thing that make it interesting. And this one is, I mean, just kind of exactly what I want from, like, wow, look at the things people did. So I just finished that over the weekend and just like, oh boy, if you like a cult story, here's a good one for you.
Love me some cult stories.
Well, there you go. Vanessa, thanks so much for joining us this week. Folks, you can find all the links that we talked about in the show notes at bookriot.com/listen. You can subscribe to Literary Activism at literaryactivism.substack.com. If you want to subscribe to Book Riot's deep dive Substack, that is bookriot.substack.com. You can read a piece Vanessa wrote recently about the weirdest moments of her life as a managing editor, including having to ask herself, is this picture of a piece of fruit too sexy for the internet?
Love my job. I really love my job.
True stories. Was a pleasure having you here, Vanessa.
Thank you so much.
Again.
It was great to be here. Thank you.